Quite a few singers have begun performing with the church choir and gone on to success in gospel or pop music. But Charlie Verrett went on to become an opera star. And what a star she's been at the New York City Opera, La Scala, the Met, Covent Garden, even the Bolshoi. She'll be the guest of honor this Sunday at the African American Composers Workshop at 3:30. At the Harlem School for the Arts at 645 St. Nicholas Avenue, and she joins me now on New York & Company. I'm honored.
I am also. Thank you very much.
Now, you're not singing at this event, are you?
No, I'm not. Isn't it a joy? I love sitting and listening to other people, and it's really great because when I looked at the program that was given to me just a few minutes ago, it really is very interesting, and I don't know these pieces, so that also makes it very exciting for me to hear music that I don't know sung by young people. Great.
This is part of a program to have more people write opera. It's from the
Center for Contemporary Opera,
and then
the Harlem School of the Art.
Yeah, and when you performed Carmen at the Bolshoi, it made newspaper headlines. An African American Negro woman. First Negro woman to sing Carmen in the Bolshoi. And that was at a time when this sort of thing was a big surprise.
Yes.
Now, since then, the world has changed a bit. But there aren't a heck of a lot of roles for people of color, are there?
Yes, there are. If they're Shirley Verrett, I sing everything. You know, for instance, in Boston, I know I raised up a few eyebrows, but I did Desdemona in Otello. And I was told that, the place was packed with people because they wanted to see this black face do
a white role.
And with the makeup, because, you know, this is the way I feel about it. When I think about opera, I don't think about really about color, because Otello, when he's white, he has to blacken down. Aida, if she's white, has to blacken down. Why can't I whiten up? And this is what I always tell people, this is what makeup is for.
Isn't it weird that we don't think of it in the other direction? You know,
what
is necessary for
exactly.
Otello.
Because, this is it. We're play acting, and so we do what we have to do.
Well, your career is atypical in a lot of ways.
Yes.
First of all, you were a winner on the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scout
yes.
show. And I can't think of too many opera stars who started off that way. And it really was key to your career, wasn't it?
Well, in a sense it was, in the sense that it brought me to New York City from California.
And Juilliard.
And because of the show, I was invited by my then teacher to come to Juilliard. And I, instead of going back to Los Angeles, I stayed here in New York and graduated from Juilliard School of Music, which was really great for me. Yes.
Now, what did you perform on Arthur Godfrey?
I'll tell you what I was supposed to have, and this is very wonderful, kind of little story, but I'll tell you, I was supposed to have done Dich Teure Halle from Tannhäuser. Mm-hmm. And my teacher then, Anna Fitzhugh, out in California, told me, she said, in thinking about it, I think you really should sing something that the public knows, because they won't know this. Mm-hmm. This just the aficionados will know this. You must sing something else. She said, what about My Heart at Thy Sweet Voice? Mon coeur s'ouvre à ta voix from Samson and Delilah, because it had been made popular by Herb Jeffries at that time, and he would sing, when I write my song, I'll write about the one who loves me, or something like that. And she said, everybody will know it. It's also very good because you can cut it in half, and it's the time period, 3 minutes. And this is how Shirley Verrett, the mezzo-soprano, was born, when I did the Mon coeur s'ouvre à ta voix. And for many years, I sang as a mezzo-soprano, in fact.
Yeah, you started as a mezzo-soprano, and then you became a soprano.
Actually, people don't know that. I started as a soprano, and because of Mon coeur s'ouvre à ta voix, the Godfrey show, my teacher then said, oh, this is, when she heard me, because she had heard me for the first time, and she heard this part of my voice. And when I went to Juilliard, I started to sing as a mezzo-soprano, which was very good for me in those years. But I really did start as a soprano in California.
Because I was going to ask about that. It seemed to me that most people's voices tend to lower as they
instead
mature.
Of going up.
You went in the opposite direction. But you had over 2-octave range, so you could simply choose where you wanted to situate your voice in a role?
It's not. You know what I feel? That I feel each one of us comes into this world with something. And as opera singers, we have these little bands in our throat. And it's either going to go up very, very high and be comfortable there, or it won't. Mm-hmm. Now, most really wonderful mezzo-sopranos have a range because it's the soprano sound, but not with the extension, except some of them do have the extension, but they can't stay there. And that's the difference. Mm-hmm. How comfortable are you? And only you can know this. I mean, a teacher can't always tell you this. You have to know for yourself. I had come from a family, if I might relate this, and maybe this is has a great deal to do with what happened with my voice. I came from a family, a very musical family, and we all sang. And my mother was supposedly the soprano in the group, but if she was doing something in the kitchen or I had to do something in the kitchen that night, I took over. Mm-hmm. If a brother who was a tenor was not there, I took over. If it was a baritone, I took over. You know, we were always, and it was not only I, but most of the family, interchangeable. And you didn't think about, oh, this is a mezzo, or this is a contralto, therefore you cannot do mm-hmm. certain things. I was just having a conversation with someone outside, and they're, you know, how people put you and want to put you in a box. I think I've always refused that. Maybe not always to my advantage, but I've always refused to be put in a particular box because people didn't know how to view me in any other way except how they first heard me. In so much so that when I made my debut at the San Francisco Opera and I sang L'Africaine, Celica, I was told, I did not read the reviews, but I was told that some of the critics felt that I had transposed it because it was so easy. And I said, I sang it the same as it's written. I didn't transpose anything. But because it seemed too easy, what is she doing singing this role mm-hmm. so easily? It had to have been transposed. It was not. So I always tell singers that you must have the intelligence to know enough about your own instrument, not to always have to be told.
But don't you sacrifice, if you start singing mostly soprano roles,
yes.
don't you lose the bottom?
No, if you vocalize as I do.
You so have you could to, still do either?
Of course. There are certain things that I cannot do anymore, and I don't want to do unless it's done in really pristine conditions. For instance, Samson and Delilah. I must have a conductor who really follows everything the composer said. If he doesn't, it will be too low for me. Mm-hmm. Because if he blasts, as what happened to me at the Met, the conductor was not sensitive. And that's the only reason I had said I would do it was because I thought this person would be sensitive to what my voice is because I am not a contralto and so forth. Well, if that is done, but I stay away from that role now because I'm afraid. Otherwise, the trovatores and the eboli, well, eboli is a different thing because it would really be written for two voices. Mm-hmm. First for the soprano and then the mezzo and so on, or vice versa. And it always intrigued me because when I read that, I said, this is why I always felt this was really a soprano role. So I still can do, I can go back and forth into some of the repertoire.
You mentioning that about the Met reminds me that opera is really performed under the worst of circumstances for the singer because there is an orchestra between the singer and the audience.
Yes.
And there's a lot of people in that orchestra. There's only one of you and
yes.
you're not mic'd and somehow you have to project your voice above and through all
yes.
of that and an orchestra can really destroy a great performance,
it
I
can.
Suspect.
It can. If the conductor is not sensitive and not really superb, it can ruin a performance.
Let's talk a bit about Africa, about opera today. First of all, one of the things you talked about being put into boxes, and you've performed a lot of modern music as part of the repertoire.
Not
as well.
Really a lot. I not really a lot. I started doing
Benjamin
this.
Britten and
yes.
Ned Roram and some others
yes,
over the years.
Yes, of course. you know, for song literature and so forth. But as and also Stravinsky and so forth, maybe he wouldn't be called a modern, but he's of our 20th century.
Anybody in the 20th century is modern.
Exactly. And, you know, Sermon and Narrative and a Prayer I recorded, and also the Oedipus Rex and so forth. And there will be, I was beginning to be put into a position where I was going to be doing a lot of contemporary works, which I would like to have done. But because I needed to fill a lot of gaps, you know, in the other literature, I didn't go into contemporary opera as much as I would like to have had, I'd like to have done. But I think it's really great that the Center for Contemporary Opera exists and that they're doing such a great job, because I always like to think of our contemporary opera, thinking in the days of Verdi and Bizet and so on. That was contemporary opera during that time. And
sure.
So we need desperately to nurture the young composers.
Is it harder to sing the contemporary things? I always think about the wear and tear of performing difficult roles night after night and acting at the same time.
Yes. I would think, well, that's one reason that I guess I didn't do too much of the contemporary opera at the time, when I could have possibly put some in, because some of the things that were offered to me I didn't think would be really great for what I was doing with my voice at the time. And I read something in the Opera Today by Richard Marshall, who's the head of this this fabulous Center for the Contemporary Opera. And he was saying that some of the same things that I feel about we have to begin to, the composers have to begin to emphasize again the importance of the underlying music, and of also communicating to the public, and from my standpoint, I will add this, with some kind of line, some kind of melodic line, even if it may be dissonant, but it has to touch the heart some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do feel that we do have people out there today doing this kind of work, and I would like to hear more of it.
The performance that you will be the guest of honor at involves Troubled Island, an opera that is
Langston Hughes.
It was from adapted
Steele.
From a play,
yes.
Right? And Grant William Grant Still was the composer.
Yes,
a name that not a lot of people
know. That's exactly right.
But Langston Hughes actually, despite ambivalence toward opera, wrote the librettos, or is it libretti, for a lot of operas, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he did. And unfortunately, I've never heard Troubled Island. It's about Haiti. You know,
19th century Haiti.
That's exactly right. And I've not heard The Barry. I haven't heard. I'm looking forward, to Sunday, because I want to be educated about some of this music that is around that I do not know.
Mm-hmm.
I say that very truthfully. I am looking forward to Sunday as much as other people who will be there.
Also, I gather that this is workshop production, but in April, the opera will be performed at the Brooklyn Museum.
Yes.
And that will be the complete opera, and
yes,
people will get a chance to see what these workshops have wrought. Do you do a lot of teaching?
I have been asked to do a lot of teaching, and I'm just beginning now to do more master classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say that I feel that I'm a good teacher, but when you have a career, I've always felt that it would be really unfair for me to get so involved with teaching and then I would have to leave, and especially not people who are more advanced, but when you're working with beginners, it is not fair. I had a teacher in California, my first teacher, who felt that way. When you went to her, she didn't care how great your voice, if you were not interested in really working to become what the potential was for your voice, she would not take you. I would not go that far, but what I do say is, at this particular point in my career, after 33 or more years in it, I am now taking on a little bit more of giving, because I have to give back something now.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel I have something to give back, and especially in the realm of teaching about things that I have done on the stage, not totally that, and also helping with certain kinds of comportment on the stage, even for giving auditions, helping young people in that way. What do you do? I remember judging something recently for the Met audition, the regional auditions, and some of the people went to the finals, and I think one or two won. I was very happy that I was one of the judges on that. But I remembered being very, very kind to some of the young ladies who walked on stage and did not know how to dress for 11 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers did not teach them that. And I feel that not only about can I speak about the music, but I can also speak about how to put yourself across when you're at auditions and so forth, because people get immediate ideas of what you are by what they see.
Pierre Boulez recently was teaching courses in New York, and he allowed young conductors to conduct the Cleveland Symphony. He said that one of the big problems that you have in teaching people is that they wind up conducting student symphonies, and they have struggles that have nothing to do with their conducting skills. So
yes.
He put this great symphony
at
it available to them, mm-hmm. and could really understand what they were good at and what they were bad at.
Great.
And give them the kind of instructions that are necessary. That's
fabulous.
Part of the problem that I'm sure a lot of singers come and have a bad accompanist.
That's it. It's true.
And they're
exactly.
sabotaged by things that they have no control over.
Exactly. Well, that goes back to the conductor, and you know, you have to, everything has to be equal for it to really be great performances, right?
My guest is Shirley Verrett, who will be the guest of honor at the African American Composers Workshop in Harlem. Is this available to everybody? Can people come by and see this?
I would think so. I'm sure that Miss Allen would really love to see the place overflowing with people who just wanted to hear, as I'm anxious to hear, these works.
And it's at 3:30.
It's at 3:30.
That's April 4th at the Harlem School of the Arts. At
645 St. Nicholas Avenue.
Okay. And I'm telling people that because I want to make sure that they understand that this thing is happening and that there is interesting contemporary music still being performed. Many people think when you ask them about black opera, they either think of Scott Joplin, Tremonisha,
yes.
or Anthony Braxton, and there's all this stuff in between,
right.
not being performed all that much.
Exactly.
Maybe if more workshops concentrate on these things, it would become part of the repertoire.
Well, this is why the Center for Contemporary Opera is so great, and also having the Harlem School of the Arts. I'd like to say something a little bit. May I say something about the Harlem School
of the
Arts?
You can say whatever you want.
I am so happy about this school because I knew, but long before we met, I knew the founder, Dorothy Maynor. She was one of my idols. I mean, one of my ideals, my heroines, my heroes, as they say today. And when she started this school, I wanted to be a part of it, and I was, and I still am, under my friend Miss Allen, Betty Allen.
And now, what do you say you were a part of it? What do you?
I was a part. I wanted to give a little bit back, and I remember in the early years, Miss Maynor asked me to go. I was one of the singers that she asked to do a benefit recital for. I went to the school. I saw the young people. It just lifted my spirits to see that and to give also a lie to the fact that not only are they trained in singing and so, but drama, dance,
mm-hmm.
the same as Arthur Mitchell with the Dance Theater of Harlem. All of this is just so great. And now the Center for Contemporary Opera, to be sure, to foster more and more composers to write music of in our time,
uh-huh.
because this is our time. We have to have it; otherwise, it's just going to be really a dearth of operas in the next two or three generations. We must have the music written.
When you came on the scene, most singers were not expected to do very much acting. It was kind of a rarity when somebody actually
yes.
could actually do acting at the same time.
Yes.
Now we're surprised when they don't.
And you know what's really great about all of that? I think I mentioned this on the television the other night about opera in English. Now, we're talking about contemporary opera, which means that it would be written in our language, English,
mm-hmm.
as most operas, all operas were written, French operas were written for the French people who understood it. What is marvelous that we have the subtitles now.
Right, so we don't have to transpose these French operas into English.
Into English, we can still do them, and you have the English words there. What it also does is that the people who were on stage just depending solely on the beauty of the voice and nothing else, there were a few of those,
mm-hmm.
cannot do this anymore because when you see the words, I mean, singing another language and many of the people in the audience not understanding, now we've got the English words there. Now, if I do a motion that is against what the words say, this is really ridiculous. And so it has put even more of a, how can I say, burden, but it's not
responsibility.
A responsibility, not a burden, because it should not be a burden. A responsibility on our shoulders to be sure that we are in sync with what is being shown to the people.
Do you find yourself being forced to sacrifice voice quality for the other? Because projecting perfect voice sometimes means standing in a certain kind of position, and then acting will often force you into another kind of position.
I really don't, because, see, this is something that I would like, well, in some schools, I suppose you already have this, where you're not standing, you're not supposed to be taught to stand up on a stage and just be able to sing in one position. You should be able, with the breath that you have and your posture, you should be able to sing in many positions, and you should practice that way.
But most people used to hold their hands under
that's
the
diaphragm. That's it. Well, you see, in those cases, then, those people would not, it would not do very well.
Put on the headphones, because we have a call from John. I know he wants to say something to you. My guest is Shirley Verrett, and John from Harlem, you're on the air.
Hello.
Good day, Ms. Verrett. I just wanted to compliment you and just tell you how absolutely personable you are. I had won some tickets about a year ago in April of 92 off of this show to see you at Carnegie. And, and not only, well, I know nothing about, you know, this type of music, but I just wanted to see you because you're a legend as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you.
I was very, very pleased with my layman's knowledge of this type of music. I was extremely pleased, and I have never, ever seen anyone get five curtain calls and do two encores. And what I was so astounded by is that you were just so extremely pleasant, because I think you had maybe 200 people after the show walk up backstage to you.
Yes.
And you spent 2 hours saying hello to every single body. And I came about an hour and a half in the crowd, and you never knew me, but you were so nice to me. You came up and you grabbed my hand. You said, "Oh, come on in." And I stood next to you for 5 minutes. I don't know if you remember that. I was just standing next to you, like, gazing at you. And you were talking to your friends, and I was standing next to you, and I got your autograph. And I was just so moved by your friendliness and your warmth that even if I did not enjoy the show, just that 15 minutes I was with you and just seeing how absolutely radiant your personality was and how absolutely personable and just down-to-earth you were, that to me would be worth everything. And, you know, that's a lifetime memory when you meet someone like that and they're so pleasant and so nice. You remember that for the rest of your life, and you end up telling your children and what have you.
John, thank you for calling.
Now, that is so great to hear.
John is also saying that you are not carrying on that other tradition of the haughty diva.
Of the diva.
Yeah.
I couldn't. I was not reared that way. My parents were such wonderful people. They always told me, listen, you are a human being. We all are born the same way, and we all go back to the same dust.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother and father used to say this, because they always felt that I would have a career from when I was young.
But nobody could have imagined this career.
My father imagined it.
Oh, great.
He was fabulous. He always said, you can do it, you can do it. My mother also, you can do it, Shirley. And they always told me, remember that when you go up that ladder, the same stairs that you go up, there's a time that you begin to come back down. Remember that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you don't think you're not coming down yet, are you?
Well, not really. You know, I don't think so, because even when I'm not singing anymore, I will be involved in something.
Mm-hmm.
I will be giving back what people have given to me. And it was just so wonderful to speak to John that minute, because what you saw, John, is really what you get, because this is really the real Shirley Verrett.
Let's take some more calls, okay? And our number is 212-267-WNYC. Mary from Queens, you're on the air.
Miss Verrett.
Yes.
I have never seen you, but I feel exactly, just from listening to you in this past, half hour,
yes,
as that gentleman can. I just love your voice.
Thank you.
And I'd like to see you somewhere.
Well, come to...
Are you ever on Charlie Rose's program?
Not yet. I hope to be, because I love him.
Wait, she's been on this show. That's better than Charlie Rose.
Speaking voice.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Grace from Manhattan, you're on New York.
Miss Verrett,
yes.
I want to join with that previous caller in sharing a reminiscence about 14 years ago. I don't know if you'll remember this. William Warfield drove my daughter and me to hear you in Peoria. You were encouraging of her. You were the most gracious, wonderful person. You made a great influence on her life. She is now a struggling opera singer, and she's got a problem that I think you can identify with. Half her teachers think she's a mezzo. The other half say she's a dramatic soprano, and she's being torn apart.
If she ever... Where does she live now?
Right here in Manhattan.
If she ever, listen, maybe you can write into the station and they can get this information to me.
Sunday.
Either do that or I'll put you on hold and you can leave your number with our with one of my producers and that can be passed on.
I would love to speak with her.
Yes, well, you were just wonderful. And I think everyone who's ever met you will attest to your gracious and really sincere presence.
Well, thank you. You're
a great woman in addition to a great singer.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to put you on hold. Thank you for calling us, Grace.
Thank you.
That suggests that people often feel that they can't approach
certain people
who are successes. And in opera, that is a real concern, you know, because the singers are often given this kind of superhuman thing in our minds.
I remember I had my dear voice teacher who is now passed away. My teacher that I did have at Juilliard, she was such a wonderful person for me and in my life and so on. But she was of the old school, as most of the people when I began were of the old school, and you were not supposed to act in a certain way. You were not supposed to be so gracious backstage. And I remember
Marion Fraschel, you're talking about?
Madame Fraschel. And I remember one year I was singing at the then-known the Philharmonic Hall, and I went out on stage. Before going out stage, my teacher had given me something. She said, "Shirley, try not to be so, you know, you come out and you're smiling and so forth. It doesn't look very diva-like," and so on. And so this time I said, well, maybe I'll try it. I walked out on stage with this, what I felt was a very queenly walk, and I didn't smile with the audience as usually. I come out smiling. About the second group, I turned to my accompanist and I said, "I can't do this. I can't. I have to be me. And if people cannot accept that, I'm very sorry." Because backstage also, they would come, the people come back, and if I know them or if I see it, and especially in those years when I didn't see too many African-Americans or blacks coming backstage, when I did see one, I'd throw my arms around them and say, "Oh, thank you so much for being here." And I went back to doing that. I'm still doing it. I will never change because I'm going back to what my beginnings, my teachings at home were. You are a human being. You don't have to put on the cloak of a diva. You are or you aren't. Mm-hmm. And make-believe just doesn't work.
My guest is Shirley Verrett. You're listening to New York & Company on AM 820 WNYC, New York Public Radio. I want to get to a few more of the calls in a moment, but I'm curious about singing in all those different languages. Do you actually have to speak German, French, Italian, Spanish? What else have you sung in? Russian?
Russian. No, Russian I don't speak. I know a few words, or I did know a few words, but what you do is this. In the Juilliard School of Music where I was trained, we must take Italian, French, German, English diction. Mm-hmm. I had already studied before coming to New York City. I had studied in California Spanish so that I could sing in Spanish.
You grew up in a town with a Spanish name, Santa Barbara.
Santa Barbara, that's it. Anyway, it does help if you do it. First of all, we were taught to know the language grammatically well enough so that we could translate our songs from the language, what German, French, or Italian, whatever, into English so that when we sing to an Italian audience, they believe what and they understand the words.
That's the hard part.
That is the hard part. You go a little farther, and as I have done singing in Italy and in France and in Germany so much, you do begin to speak the language. I lived in Germany at the beginning of the career. Actually, well, my last year in Juilliard with a German family. In those years, I spoke pretty good German. I sing German, I think, perfectly these days. I don't speak the German language, but once I'm there for a few days, it begins to come back, and I can hold very simple conversations. In Italian, I can do interviews. It's really a more fluent language, and in French, I can do. I mean, I had the nerve to go on television for this show that they were putting on for on my life and so forth, speaking French. It helps. Because then what happens is you begin, you know, when you study the language, you think in that language. You begin to think. You get up in the morning and you don't say good morning. If you're in French, you say bonjour. You say buongiorno. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you don't think of English.
And when you're singing, you're not translating in your head
And you're not translating in your head. The words are there. Mm-hmm. and you're singing in their language. Now, I will never say, I will not go to say that you get so good that you know every little nuance of what one word might mean, but you get so close that people enjoy it as if they're listening, and sometimes even more so than when they're listening to their own people sing in the language, because when we sing in our own languages, we become a little bit lazy. Mm-hmm. We think, oh, this is my language. They have to understand me. Wrong. This is why at the Juilliard School of Music, we had to take, as singers, English diction because of the connections, because certain words would sound ridiculous if you connected them together.
Let's try to get a few more calls in here because we have very limited time, and I know a lot of people want to speak to Shirley Verrett. Harris from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Lenny. I saw Miss Verrett's debut at the Met as Eboli and Don Carlo.
Oh, you did?
And was it
that goes back.
Or Marcel Schulte who conducted it?
No, it was actually Abbado, I think, wasn't it?
Claudio
Abbado.
Well, and I also saw you with Leopold years before.
Oh, my.
Leopold Stokowski in the Philadelphia Orchestra and Elamor Brujo, I think, in
Carnegie. Yes, that was it.
I, as somebody who loves opera because Verdi and Wagner and Mozart and Strauss are great dramatists, I want to express my deep appreciation to you for saying that singers should make up. I think that is so. A white tenor has to apply makeup to be a Otello, and I think it was very intelligent, and I think very courageous of you to say that you should make up to be Desdemona. I think that shows a genuine deep appreciation of the art.
Yes, because we're not on the stage trying to be Shirley Verrett or whoever. We're trying to be that character.
And we're not trying to make a political
statement.
And we're
not making a political statement. This is the make-believe world. What if? Mm-hmm. It's a magic world.
Yes, and I wish more white performers would pay attention to their appearance, too, when they get out.
I thank you for calling us, Harris.
Thank you.
Dorothy from Long Island, you're on New York and Company.
Oh, good afternoon. So nice to speak to both of you.
Thank you.
When Miss Verrett was mentioning Langston Hughes, it brought back such memories to me, and I want to redeem New York City education as it was. When I was 15 years old in high school, we learned about Langston Hughes. I could quote you a poem if I have a second, give you two lines. It was a poem, "Seen you down at church not last night, never mind Miss Lucy," et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
I won't go into it.
Yes.
But we were studying John Drinkwater's play about Abe Lincoln in Illinois. And as a project, we did a book. I was first the art editor and then the editor of it. The book weighed 7.5 pounds.
Oh, my God.
We went back. At that time, Life magazine had renewed itself, and I had friends who had copies of it from the beginning, and we did the whole history. Now, we called the book The American Negro, and some people said it was a misnomer, A Black Man in a White Man's Country. I don't know. Thoughts about that have gone back and forward. But we did learn so much, and I can tell you, everyone from Phyllis Wheatley on, Benjamin Bannister, everyone, we really went into depth into this.
And when was this?
This was in New York City, Walton High School at the time, an all-girls school.
Well, you were very, very fortunate in those years to have learned about African-Americans or blacks or Negroes, as we were called then. Because, you know, this is something that we're fighting about now, that we're working towards now, to have more that we do belong in the all of the books in the schools where we are not listed as, we were just listed as we came over as slaves or we were mm-hmm. brought over as slaves and so on. And so you went to a very rare school.
And we thank you for
thank
your
you.
Call. Elizabeth from Brooklyn, you're on New York and Company.
Hello. I just wanted to express my admiration for Miss Verrett. I can't tell you what an inspiration you are to all of us who are studying classical music and who are Black American. And I saw the program at Carnegie Hall last year, and I was absolutely enthralled.
Thank you.
Particularly during your encore from Don Carlo.
Oh, the
when you began to move. It was so magical. I cannot tell you.
And thank you.
I hope I have the opportunity to meet you sometime because you've been a tremendous inspiration for me.
Thank you very much.
As a singer?
Yes.
Oh, so you're studying, you're a singer?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. God bless you.
Thank you so much for your call. And we should, allow you to leave, I should point out that the Center for Contemporary Opera, in cooperation with the Harlem School of the Arts, will revive some of the musical collaborations of Langston Hughes in an African-American opera workshop. One will be offered on Saturday, this Saturday, April 3rd, and another one on Sunday, April 4th. The April 3rd performance at 3 p.m. will take place at the Brooklyn Museum on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, and the April 4th performance will be at 3:30 at the Harlem School of the Arts, 141st Street and St. Nicholas Avenue in Manhattan. The second one will also feature a guest appearance from my wonderful guest, Shirley Verrett. Thank you so much for having been on New York.
It's been great being here. Thank you.
Saprà in brev'ora chi sia la donna.